Welcome to Who Should Manage Public Lands in Utah, an Oxford-style debate sponsored by the Salt Lake Tribune, the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, and KCPW Public Radio 88.3 and 105.3 FM. Good evening. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. I'll be the moderator for this evening's event. An illegal ATV ride in San Juan County, a dispute over wild horses in Iron County, talk of another national monument, and an armed standoff between a Nevada rancher and the Federal Bureau of Land Management show that long-standing tensions over who manages public lands are running pretty high right now in the West. Nearly 23 million acres of land in Utah is managed by the BLM, and tonight a panel of experts will debate the issue of who is best funded and best able to manage those public lands, the state or the feds. The resolution for the debate is as follows. The state of Utah is best suited to manage public lands within its borders. And arguing in favor of the motion is Utah House Speaker Rebecca Lockhart. She's a Republican from Provo who served in the state legislature since 1999. Her teammate, State Representative Ken Ivory, is a Republican of West Jordan and president of the American Lands Council, which advocates transfer of public lands to the states. Arguing against the motion, Patrick Shea, an attorney in private practice and former director of the Bureau of Land Management, and Dr. Daniel McCool, political science professor and director of the Environmental and Sustainability Studies Program at the University of Utah. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished panel. We're broadcasting live before a full house from the Salt Lake City Library in downtown Salt Lake City, and we're being broadcast on KCPW 88.3, 105.3 FM, and a live video streaming is an option at sltrib.com. It's great to see so many engaged members of our community tonight. It's a full house. The rules for tonight's event are as follows. Each team will offer timed opening and closing statements. They'll also have time to respond to one question from the Tribune newsroom and one question from their opponents. Because we're on a tight timetable again, please hold your applause until the end of their statements. And you will play a role in tonight's event as well. We want to get a sense of how you feel about the public lands issue right now. So if you're in the listening audience, if you're in the audience here in the auditorium, pull out your cell phone, please. This is just like American Idol. You can get ready to send a text. Here's the number. Send your text to the number 22333. I will tell you when to go. Not quite yet. 22333. You'll next type in the keyword, and it depends. The keyword depends on how you feel about this issue. Again, our pre-debate question is the state of Utah is best suited to manage the public lands within its borders. If you don't agree, type in feds, F-E-D-S. If you do agree, type in Utah, U-T-A-H, and hit send. And we will see how the results start to come in. There they go. Great. I'm glad you're all figuring it out. Just a reminder, it doesn't matter if the word is capitalized, but extra spaces are going to make a difference. And if you have a texting plan where you're charged by the text, I'm sorry, you're going to get a charge. You've got about 5 minutes to vote, so go ahead, do it right now. One phone number equals one vote, and then we'll shut down this voting session in a few minutes, and we'll vote again at the end of the program to see the powers of persuasion right before your very eyes. While you're voting, I'd like to invite Morgan Lyon Cotty to the stage. She's the state and local program manager with the Hinckley Institute of Politics. She's here with a brief introduction of the topic at hand. And Dr. Cotty, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First off, you've done a fair bit of research on this for the Hinckley Institute as well as for the Utah Foundation. How much do people care about public lands issues in Utah?
It's really interesting to see how the different groups view this issue. Surveys by Utah Foundation and Hinckley Institute done by Dan Jones and Associates in the past few elections showed that Republican delegates view this as a really high priority. When asked about their top priorities, they said state issues was their top priority, and then access to federal lands was another top priority. When Republican voters in general were asked this question, they also were concerned with state issues. However, not so much with federal lands. When all voters were asked, neither of these issues really came to the forefront. And a more recent proprietary poll done by Dan Jones and Associates found that one-third of Republican delegates viewed the overreach of the federal government as a very big concern for them. However, when we asked all voters, only about 14% saw that as a big concern. So it's a really interesting thing to see this gap between these groups and who view this as a top priority.
This has been a real hot-button issue, though, for many, many years. Can you put this into some historical perspective?
Absolutely. This has been an issue several times throughout Utah's history. Most recently and most visibly was the Sagebrush Rebellion of the 1970s and the early 1980s. This was in large part a reaction to a federal law passed in 1976 that stated all lands in the quote-unquote public domain would stay under federal control. Several state legislatures in the West took umbrage with this and tried to pass their own legislation to say that they were actually in control of those lands. A bill like this did pass Utah's legislature, and Governor Matheson said he would sign it if protections for the environment and endangered species was included. However, a similar Nevada law was actually struck down by the courts, which basically invalidated Utah's bill. Eventually, this movement sort of ran out of steam. It wasn't able to maintain the type of political support that's needed for such large-scale changes.
As we proceed with tonight's debate, what advice do you have for those in the listening audience, for those here in the auditorium? What should they be thinking about? One thing that they should be thinking about as they listen to our debaters.
This is a very complicated and really multifaceted issue. Some people view this as an east-west fight or an intra-regional issue. Others think that this is a state's rights issue, and still others view this as the environment versus development. And there's a very long history to land issues. Even going back to the founding of our country, when seven of the original colonies laid claim to the same lands, so-called western lands, which were really just leading up to the Mississippi at that time. So throughout our nation's history, there's been many decisions, many compromises made about federal lands, and Utahns need to come to a consensus about what is the best course of action for our state and for our lands.
Dr. Morgan Lyon-Cotty of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, thank you so much. All right, let's get to the activity at hand. Before the program, the teams tossed a coin to determine who goes first, and the winner was those who were in favor of the motion that the state of Utah is best suited to manage public lands. I'm going to call you Team A. Team A has selected to go first. So Team A, arguing for the resolution, will go first. Please step up to the mic. You will have 6 minutes for your opening statement, starting now.
Jennifer, Pat, Dan, Professor Cotty, thank you very much. Honored guests and friends, I'm honored to be here to discuss this question, this important, critical question. Who should manage public lands in Utah? This is not a new question. In fact, it's older than our nation. The real question, though, is whether we'll be managed of the people, by the people, and for the people, or whether we'll be managed of the bureaucracy, by the bureaucracy, and for the bureaucracy. You know that King George and his ministers, they deemed the colonies incapable of handling the complexity of managing their own land. And that led to the establishment of a totally unique form of government. A government based on a partnership between the state and federal government to secure the rights of liberty and property and self-governance. This is where the public land question begins. In 1780, you see, the nation was in the middle of the Revolutionary War and they were out of money, and it was the states that stepped up. And as Professor Cotty said, it was the states that controlled the western lands, and they stepped up and said, we will grant our lands to you, national government, in trust on two express conditions, that you only use the lands to create new states with the same rights of sovereignty, freedom, and independence as all the other states, and use the proceeds to pay the debt of the war. They reaffirmed this trust arrangement in 1784, in 1787, and in the Constitution, where it says that Congress only has the power to dispose of these lands, and in no way to change any of the rights of the states to have the federal government transfer the title. From 1780 until our statehood, courts, congresses, and presidents reaffirmed that the federal government only holds territorial lands, quote, in trust for the states ultimately to be created. Not many decades had passed, and this conflict between government of the people and of the bureaucracy raised its ugly head again. Western states, you see, could not be trusted to manage their public, to manage their own lands. And for many decades, the then Western states were as much as 90% federally controlled for decades, and they were stifled in their opportunities to fund education and grow their economies, they said. The founding principles of self-governance were so ingrained in the DNA of these states that they refused to take no for an answer, and it was Illinois and Missouri and Arkansas and Louisiana and Alabama, and of course, you know, that great western state of Florida, that banded together to compel the federal government to transfer title to their public lands. You see, this has already been done before, and their statehood agreements have the same Utah Enabling Act language that many bureaucrat types and others refer to say, to deny Utah from the right and the privilege of managing our own lands and our own lives and our own resources. This has been done before. It was in 1896 that Utah was made a state with the same statehood terms to transfer the public lands as North Dakota and all the states east of Colorado. The promises are the same. By 1915, the Utah legislature demanded the president and the Congress for a speedy return to the policy of transferring title of the public lands. They said, quote, in the spirit and letter of the 1780 land grant to the national government, and in conformity with the terms of our Enabling Act for the strength of the nation, that this should happen. By 1932, the Western states again were pushing against bureaucratic control and to compel Congress to transfer title to the public lands. A bill was proposed for granting public lands to the states, but the federal agencies, you see, they opposed the bill unless it left complete control of all the minerals with the agencies. Governor George Dern, Democrat of Utah, remarked that the Western states appreciate the compliment that they're now grown up enough to be trusted to take care of our surface lands more wisely than the federal government, but the question remains as to why they're not wise enough to manage the minerals. Governor Dern and the Western states rejected this proposal that takes everything that's worth anything at all and leaves the states with nothing but the skin of a squeezed lemon. By the mid-1980s, Governor Scott Matheson, Democrat of Utah, wrote of federal control, the federal government's influence has become more pervasive, more intrusive, more unmanageable, more inefficient, more costly, and above all, more unaccountable. Any federal solution of the budget deficit will almost inevitably include a major return of responsibility to the states. And he said the states are capable and they're ready for this challenge. Today, the economic and environmental urgency is so apparent, as Governor Scott Bullock from Montana, Democrat from Montana, said just last year at the Western Governors Association. You know, Montana and Utah manage millions of acres of public land for multiple use, and they do it while still protecting endangered species and habitat. But on the federal lands, the story's not the same, he said. Wildlife habitat is degraded, watersheds are at extreme risk, endangering fisheries and clean water, fire danger off the charts, threatening communities and stifling recreation. They put together a diverse group of Montanans and spent years coming up with a plan that they could all support. And it was then they took their plan to Washington that they learned that Washington's not interested in finding solutions.
30 seconds.
Yes, they know that Congress is too polarized. Yes, the forest management is broken, but no, they can't do anything about it. He said, now it's up to Westerners to bring forward answers. You see, it's clear that not only can Utah afford to manage our public lands to fund education and better care for the environment and grow our economy locally and nationally, quite simply, we can't afford not to.
10 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you. Team B. Arguing against the resolution, Pat Shea. You have 6 minutes.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Becky and Ken for participating in this common square tonight. I think it's in the best tradition of Utah and the United States that we have a free and open debate. I think it's important that we also recognize the importance of sharing responsibility for many different problems we face. The concept in Utah of putting your shoulder to the wheel is something that I've always felt very important, having been born in this state and lived here now for many, many years, as my young children will tell you. I do think that there are some important issues that are being glossed over. When the Revolutionary War was completed, each of the 13 states decided that they were going to retain their independence. So we had an Articles of a Confederation, and that simply did not work. So literally, 227 years ago today, 55 men met in Philadelphia and began working on what would become the federal Constitution, because they understood the importance of having a united government as opposed to a divided government. They also, following Montesquieu, believed that there should be a challenge between the three branches, the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch. And unfortunately, in the last, I would say, 20 or 30 years, really beginning in 1980, the federal government has become the popular enemy of many people in Utah and in the West. And in many ways, it's understandable. There are decisions that had to be made that are not popular, and somebody in Washington seemed to be taking responsibility. I don't disagree that there are ways in which some lands in Utah or in other states in the West could be better managed by state government, but there are processes in place. Change is not like a light switch, even though Ken likes to talk about how it has to happen under the Enabling Act. The kind of change he's talking about doesn't simply go on or off. There is a thing called the Recreation and Public Purpose Act, where when I was director of BLM, we rationalized different landscapes by letting cities, counties, states, and not-for-profit organizations assume control, management, and in some instances, actual ownership of public land. But it was done on a rational basis. It wasn't, I'm in charge here and you'll do it my way. All you have to do is go down to Kane County and see the oil spill that was discovered there on lands that had been managed by the state. When the Grand Staircase was created, it was taken over by the feds. And it took more than 17 years to discover some invaluable public lands had been harmed by irresponsible oil and gas exploration on those public lands. So I think it's important that we look at the 150 years that the taxpayers of the United States have been paying for the lands that now the Utah wants to take. Are the citizens of New Jersey or Washington State or New York going to sit back and say, no, go ahead, take those lands, those 22.9 million acres of land in Utah, you can have them. A more rational approach, in my judgment, would be much like was done in Arizona. Governor Babbitt, later Secretary Babbitt, went ahead and worked with the federal government to divide up this crazy mosaic landscape. You have to understand the lines of the boundaries that we now call Utah, Wyoming, Nevada, were drawn literally by drunken surveyors who were paid by how many miles they could get done in a day. There was no attention paid to whether it made ecological sense. And then we decided, quite wisely, there should be some school trust lands. So they were made arbitrarily in this mosaic fashion. In Arizona, what Governor Babbitt, later Secretary, did was to work with the federal government so the tribes, Arizona State, and the federal government could have allotments of land that were together, so they could be managed more systematically. And I would suggest, with all respect, that Becky and Ken look at this kind of plan so that the mineral assessment could be made and that could go to the states. But the lands along river areas where the biodiversity is most important, areas where there are established wilderness study areas, they should be part of a national treasury that we keep for future generations, future legacies, that the desire to develop those lands for mineral purposes or building purposes could often out-trump the process. I did a history on City Creek Canyon, and it was interesting to me in going to City Creek Canyon that Brigham Young was one of the first environmentalists the state had. He was so upset with what Parley P. Pratt had done to Parley's Canyon, Immigration Canyon, he took ownership of City Creek Canyon and closed it to anyone who could, no one could go there unless they had written permission from him. So today, Utah, Salt Lake City, gets 30% of its culinary water because there was that kind of vision. It's that kind of vision that we need for the future of these public lands. We should come up with a solved way or a solution that will allow us to hand over to future generations the kind of legacy that Brigham Young left us. Thank you.
All right, Team A, it's your turn. Your 6 minutes starts now.
Thank you. During my 16 years in the Utah legislature and the past 4 years as Speaker of the House, most people have come to know me as someone who has a bit of a reputation for harshly criticizing the federal government and federal programs. What most don't know, however, is that my father was a dedicated federal employee for nearly four decades. He was a proud employee of the Department of Agriculture with the United States Forest Service, the agency charged with the proper care and stewardship of our national forests. He was a district ranger on two of those national forests, and he would spend hours and hours on his beloved horse, Ace, surveying and planning for the health and safety of the public lands. Now, he put up with a fair amount of ribbing from other rangers because he was among the first to have a master's degree in his field. But it gave him some particular foresight all those years ago into the looming management problems we are seeing play out today. He saw forest land management plans become a farce as errant policies, a flood of litigation, and an ever-growing national debt resulted in hundreds of millions of animals being slaughtered by wildfires or overpopulation. He watched as watersheds and innumerable acres of forest were systematically destroyed through inattention, making the land significantly less productive for future generations. The federal agencies are suffering the consequences of outdated and erroneous policies and processes. Now, as is often the case, the competent and professional line officers on the ground know how to execute good plans. But they have been hamstrung by an unaccountable bureaucracy thousands of miles away, a bureaucracy easily swayed by those who whisper politically motivated policy imperatives in their ears. And the results speak for themselves. National parks, as well as the BLM lands and national forests, are billions and billions of dollars behind in maintenance. Bark beetles have devastated millions of acres across the West, creating future catastrophic losses of wildlife, vegetation, and watershed. Now, speaking of the bark beetles, the Forest Service is just now getting around to attempting to mitigate years of poor management decisions in the Dixie National Forest. For years, the bark beetles have been destroying that forest, leaving it a massive fire hazard. Proper management dictates that the problem should have been addressed when it was in its early stages, when our own state forester recognized the problem. Instead, lack of federal planning has led us to what I call management by emergency. We have a federal government running around attacking the symptoms by quite literally putting out fires instead of addressing the problem itself when it only affected 100 acres instead of 36,000. Now, how does this come about? Obviously, land management is a complicated thing, but one statistic sticks out. In the 1980s, the Forest Service was spending 70% of its budget on management. That number is now just 30%. Where has that money gone? Fire suppression, a necessity due to poor management, administrative support, and litigation. When we talk about managing by emergency, just today, it was reported in the press that the BLM was granted emergency approval to remove 200 feral horses from Utah rangeland. This one issue tells you all you need to know about the state of federal public lands management. An unmanaged and unhealthy herd is wreaking havoc on a portion of our state, and the BLM has to grant emergency approval to handle it. Well-managed systems do not govern by emergency approval. In contrast, the deer, elk, and bison herds throughout Utah are managed by state agencies. These animal populations are healthy and thriving because Utah's Division of Wildlife Resources has implemented long-term strategies that work. Highway fencing, wildlife underpasses, predator control. This is how you properly manage public lands. Now, when it comes to national parks, we don't have to look too far back to see the problems with the federal shutdown. Our national parks are vital to Utah's economic health, as well as our reputation as a premier destination, yet they were simply shuttered as non-essential. Utahns know they are absolutely essential, and it was only with the combined efforts of the legislature and Governor Herbert that we were able to reopen them with our own state money. We've proven we can manage the lands we control now by implementing scientifically based plans that preserve wildlife, wilderness, recreation, and tourism. Utahns will be the best at managing all the public lands within our borders. Thank you.
Team B, you're up. Dan McCool, the floor is yours. Your 6 minutes starts now.
Thank you, Jennifer. And thanks to KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and the Hinckley Institute of Politics. This is precisely the kind of discussion that we need for this kind of issue. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming out tonight. You can tell how much we care about public lands just by how many people showed up tonight. So thanks for being here. I want to talk about a little historical context here and set the legal framework for tonight's debate. Now I'm going to talk about three things that I consider to be myths. First myth, quote, the federal government made a promise to transfer title to the public lands. I took that directly off the American Lands Council website. In fact, no law or Supreme Court case has ever made that promise. No law or Supreme Court case has ever promised that there'd be an equal amount of public domain lands in every state. Here's what the Constitution actually says about the disposal of public lands. I'm going to quote to you directly from the U.S. Constitution. The Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations. That's all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. And indeed, the U.S. Congress, elected by the people, has done that. And they've passed a lot of laws regarding how to manage and dispose of public lands. In the 19th century, they passed a whole series of giveaway laws, the Homestead Act, the General Mining Act, the Timber Culture Act, the Desert Land Act, multiple railroad land grants. In total, the federal government very generously gave to Western states, corporations, and individuals living in the West 1.3 billion acres of land that used to be in the public domain. So they have given a lot of land to people in this area. Now, in the 20th century, the policy began to change, and Congress changed the laws in response to changing American values and a changing economy. In 1976, Congress passed the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, sometimes called FLTMA. And FLTMA sets up a multiple use regime for the public domain lands, and it is the Organic Act for the modern Bureau of Land Management, the BLM. providing for multiple uses when there are so many different claimants and so many different stakeholders is a very difficult job. But they do it. They're doing it. And it's not just the recreationists or the environmentalists. In Utah, 22 million acres are in grazing permits, with 1,462 grazing permittees. In Utah, there are 3.8 million acres in oil and gas leases on BLM lands, with 3,574 permits. And of course, there's all kinds of recreational activity on BLM lands, both motorized and non-motorized. And those lands form the heart and soul of our economy. They're crucially important. If you look at where Utah gets its money, the biggest chunk comes from the federal government. The next biggest chunk is tourism and recreation. Those lands are crucial to our economy. Myth number two, at statehood, the federal government promised all newly created states that it would transfer title to our public lands. Again, that's directly from the website of the American Lands Council. In fact, exactly the opposite promise was made. Let me read directly from the Utah Enabling Act. This is the act that set up the state of Utah. It says, quote, "The people inhabiting said state do agree and declare that they forever disclaim all right and title to the unappropriated public lands lying within the boundaries thereof." Forever. Not till 2014 or 2015. Forever. However, the U.S. government continued its policy of giving Western states lands, and there's a long list of lands that are allocated to the new state of Utah. They include all the school trust lands. That's all formerly
1 minute.
Public lands. Land for the University of Utah. It's a really incredibly smart thing that they did there. And land for a variety of other schools. But it ends with this statement to remind the state of Utah of the situation. Again, quoting from the Utah Enabling Act, "The said state of Utah shall not be entitled to any further or other grants of land for any purpose than is expressly provided for in this act."
30 seconds.
And myth number three, I keep hearing people say, we got to get the land back for Utah. Get the land back. This land has never been in Utah hands. Never. The United States fought a war of aggression against Mexico and took this in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, and it's been public federal land ever since then. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Who Should Manage Public Lands in Utah, a debate sponsored by the Salt Lake Tribune, the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, and KCPW. We're broadcasting live from the City Library in downtown Salt Lake City and at sltrib.com. You can also hear us at 88.3 and 105.3 FM. Now, the time for a couple of questions from the Tribune newsroom. Team A arguing for the motion. I don't know if both of you want to step to the podium or not. Okay. I'm actually going to give you three questions, and you can choose which to address. Both of you have talked about the Enabling Act, and Representative Ivory, maybe you can tell us exactly where in the Enabling Act you say that the transfer of public land should come about. The second question is the cost for the state of Utah. You brought this up, Becky Lockhart. It costs the state $9 million to reopen 9 national parks during the 16-day federal government shutdown last fall. $9 million for 16 days. If the state takes over public land management, how are you going to pay for it? And the third question is, you both sort of alluded that the government closer to the people works better, but is there some value in having some distance from local political and economic pressures? And you each can decide how you want to attack this, and you've got... 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Let me read an enabling act to you. It says, the people inhabiting the state forever disclaim all right and title to the waste or unappropriated public lands. That's Alabama's enabling act. And they have less than 5% federally controlled lands. And it's Louisiana's and Nebraska's and Oklahoma's and North and South Dakota's. And with respect to a policy change, the Supreme Court, which is what opened the door for us, 5 years ago, the United States Supreme Court unanimously held that the consequences of a state's admission are instantaneous, and it ignores the uniquely sovereign character of that event to even suggest that somehow subsequent acts or policies of Congress can diminish what was already bestowed at statehood, particularly where all of a state's public lands are at stake. You see, the Enabling Act is a solemn compact with rights and enforceable obligations on both sides. That's the United States Supreme Court. And that's all that Utah is asking for, that they honor the same statehood compact that they kept with North Dakota. North Dakota that has 20,000 jobs just looking for people. They're putting billions of dollars right into schools and school buildings and roads, and they manage their own land. With respect to your question on do we need some buffer on local control, that would seem to suggest that there's no political dynamic or control in Washington. We have a federal government that's $1.3 trillion indebted to the Chinese. We have a federal government that has 83,000 pages of regulations that are run through. And so to think that this is a situation that would only happen on local control, at the local level, we do this. We get to meet with the people. We get to get out, and you know my phone number. You know where we live. You get to choose your representatives, and 10 or 20 people can change your representative at the local level where you meet directly with them. That doesn't happen at Washington, where you have that responsiveness and responsibility and accountability for the lives and livelihoods on the ground.
Time. We'll have to catch the money question later. All right. Team against the motion. Okay. Three questions for you. You say there's a distrust of the federal government and that that's understandable. Why do you distrust state government? County officials are frustrated with the gridlock and bureaucracy of the BLM and the Forest Service. Why is managing public land so complicated, and how would you suggest making the process more county friendly? And my third question is, you say the federal government has the expertise to do this job best. But here living in the state of Utah, there's you, Pat Shea, former BLM director. We have another former BLM director, Kathleen Clark, working for the Herbert administration. There are people living here with expertise on point. What's the difference if the feds manage versus a qualified team of locals at the state level? And your 2 minutes starts now.
I'll answer the first and third, and my professor friend will answer the second one. The answer to the first one is John Swallow, Mark Shurtleff.
Please hold your applause.
The answer to the third one is we don't have the funding. When I was director of BLM, we increased the funding for fires. There had been a policy in Republican and Democratic administrations of putting the fire out as soon as it appeared. Secretary Babbitt and President Clinton developed a policy to begin letting forest fires do what they do well, and that's get rid of these processes that have been overburdened. I don't disagree with Becky, and certainly her father was an expert on that. But again, we need to cooperate, as we have been doing on these fire situations for the last 2 years. Governor Huntsman created an integrated force of county, state, and federal firefighters that have worked well, and they will continue if we don't keep getting into these false debates.
Here's why managing public lands is so difficult. In Utah, in 1950, the population was 688,000. Today, it's over 2.8 million. The U.S. population in 1950 was 157 million. Today, it's 314 million. There are 314 million owners of the public lands. So there's a lot of input, a lot of interest, and balancing those is a very difficult job. I frankly think the BLM has actually done a pretty good job under very, very difficult circumstances. Thanks.
Okay. At this point in our event, the teams will have an opportunity to ask each other a question. Team A, you may ask your question for 1 minute, and Team B, you may have 5 minutes to respond. And Becky Lockhart.
Thank you. We believe that we've established that the states, not the federal bureaucracies, have history on their side when it comes to who should manage public lands. We've shown that the results of ignoring the very nature of our governing partnership has led to a federal bureaucracy trying to manage those lands that is billions of dollars behind in maintenance, burning down national forests, killing untold numbers of animals, and devastating air quality and watersheds for generations. They're shutting off access all over the West and shutting down our national parks as non-essential. Now, while we understand you might not want to answer this directly, we ask that you would do your best to explain why might Utahns be inclined to trust the same federal bureaucracy to properly manage public lands going forward.
Team B, your response, you have 5 minutes. Starting
thank you.
Now.
Interesting question, and I would simply look at what I did when I was director of BLM. We came in after the 1994 election where there was a contract for America, or some people said a contract on America. The BLM had 12,500 employees. When the Clinton-Bush transition happened, we had it down to 9,500. We had reduced the size of the BLM. Last year, or actually, excuse me, in 1989, when the Obama administration took over, it was back at 11,500. I found in the hallway of the director's office more than half the people there were Republicans who came in as political appointees and then metamorphized into civil servants. So what happens is you were burrowing in as Republicans to take over these different, quote, bureaucracies because they were fairly steady jobs. So I don't think the question of bureaucracy is a problem at the federal level. It exists at all levels of state organizations or federal organizations and any large organization. Try to get a hold of Google, as I did today, and I was on hold for 2 hours because they have this automated system. So I don't think, with all due respect, that bureaucracy is the problem. The problem, quite frankly, on the land management side is the constant cutting of budgets and not funding adequately those people who need to do the job that needs to be done on our forests, on our public lands, and particularly on our waterways. For the last 23 years, we have been going through this delusional process that somehow the very wealthy shouldn't pay their fair share of taxes, and instead, we should deprive the public servants from doing their public duty. We've got to change that, or we will continue to have these kind of wildfires that burn out of control. Our waterways will be polluted. And as climate change hits harder and harder, we will not have the resources at a federal level to deal with them. So I think it's time that we come up with some resolutions, some good thinking about what's going on. And instead of getting into these artificial debates of us against them, it's all we. We're the people of the United States. We ought to solve our problems. And I hope that we're able to move ahead on that. And I'll sit down so we get more time to have discussions.
We have a little more time. Okay. 3 minutes.
Part of the reason why public lands today are so difficult to manage is because of short-sighted policies in the past. We made some bad decisions in the past regarding overgrazing and the way we managed timber, and today we are suffering the results of those short-sighted policies. And we are in an adjustment period where we're trying to change that, but it's going to be difficult, and we're going to have some serious problems. Changing those policies and coming up with adaptive, sustainable management plans costs money. And that means we can't underfund initiatives like that and expect them to actually survive. And on the flip side, the other problem we have is we continually subsidize extractive industries and the kinds of things that actually damage the land the most. If you want to pay for those things, you should have to pay for them not in your tax bill, but when you actually buy the product. So if we quit subsidizing the damaging industries and activities, and we start caring for the land in a long-term, sustainable manner, we can solve these problems. And
1 minute.
Let me just reiterate something that Pat said, and I think this is really important. It's not the state of Utah versus the United States government. All of us are citizens of both of those entities. It's the state of Utah working with the United States government. It's all these entities working together collaboratively. That's how we solve problems. When we get together and we think
30 seconds.
And we communicate and we listen, we can actually solve problems. And I think that's the way to go. Thanks.
Okay, let's turn the tables. The question is from Team B, your question for Team A, and you have 1 minute, starting now.
Ken, during the Salt Lake Tribune webcast, I asked you, did you support or did you oppose what Clive and Bundy had been doing in southern Nevada? I didn't ever get an answer, and I think the people here tonight and the people listening over KCPW are entitled to an answer to that question. Second question, we, the state of Utah, has spent over $10 million on RS-2477 roads. We have yet to have a single judicial victory on that question. We have wasted the education of 2,000 Utah students by the money we have wasted on figmented judicial decisions.
Ken, everything that I read came directly from the Utah Enabling Act. And what I would like to know is, you remember that movie when they said, show me the money? I want to see the language that actually makes the promise that you keep referring to. Give me a citation. Give me a court case. Give me a law.
Time.
Give me some kind of information on it.
Time. Thank Thanks. You. All right. Team A, you have 5 minutes for your response.
This
Starting
is not a
now.
Debate about a rancher in Nevada. This issue is so much bigger than that. That's why legislative leaders from all over.
Please hold your applause. Please hold your applause. Thank you.
People are frustrated all over the West. As we mentioned, Governor Bullock from Montana. Fire is devastating the land and the wildlife, the habitat, the watershed. This is an issue impacting the entire West. That's why legislative leaders all around the West got together to restore balance in our governing system that is clearly out of balance. With respect to the Enabling Act, it says the people inhabiting the lands forever disclaim all right and title until, if you read the rest of the sentence, it says until title thereto shall have been extinguished. And then it also says that 5% of the proceeds of the sale of public lands which shall be sold, shall be paid to the state to support the common schools. You can take the rest of that.
No catcalls, please. Please. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to address one of the things that was brought up, which had to do with the cost to reopen the national parks. And I think it's important that we address one of the myths that is coming from the federal side, and that is that somehow the state of Utah wants to take over the national parks. House Bill 148 made it very, very clear that Utah has no interest in taking back or having transferred to her the national parks. There are 5 national parks, 7 national monuments and historic sites, and 33 congressionally designated wilderness areas. Those are off the table. We're not talking about those. We hope that everyone will stop talking about those areas because we agree with those. Those are congressionally designated national parks, national monuments, and wilderness areas. And we enjoy those as people. We want those to stay managed by the federal government, and rightly so. So let's move away from that. Let's stop talking about that. The reason that we paid $9 million for 16 days to open the national parks is because they were so incredibly critical to the national or to the local economies in those areas of the state. We could not survive as a state in those economies without having those parks open. So we did what we need to do as a state, which is to use state tax money to open those parks. And by the way, that money has not been paid back yet. We'll see if it will, but we are more than happy to have had those parks reopened for those 16 days. Ken brings something up very important, and that is this discussion about the Enabling Act. Read the entire Enabling Act. Read all of the language of the Enabling Act until the lands are disposed of and the proceeds shall be given to the school children of the states. Until and shall are incredibly important words. The promise was kept to the eastern states and the Midwest states. The promise has not been kept. The promise that was made in the contract at statehood with the western states. That's all we're talking about. We're talking about having the federal government live up to the same contractual promise at statehood that was made with the other states.
In fact, there's a law review done by Brigham Young University that came out a month and a half ago that goes into great detail and says that there's a very credible constitutional case to be made on this term of the Enabling Act that the federal government needs to honor its obligations. With respect to access, I'm glad you brought that up, because in every travel management plan by the BLM and the Forest Service, they're shutting off access all over the West. Thousands of roads all over the West and states all over the West.
Please hold your applause.
And it's the state of Utah that is spending millions of dollars to keep that access open for you. With respect to the cost that Pat Shea brought up, Nevada just came out with a report last month that said that managing the BLM lands, Utah, they looked at Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, Idaho, managing the similar lands in Utah, Utah generates $33 an acre positive net revenue.
30 seconds.
While the BLM loses 91 cents an acre. Yes, indeed, we cannot afford to manage it the way the federal government does, but we can't afford not to do it the way the state does.
Okay. Thank you. Time now for our closing statements. Team B will go first for a closing statement. 2 minutes. Pat Shea.
The first thing I'd like to point out is if we raise the grazing fees from $1.39 to where the state charges $11 or private land charges $20 an AUM or animal unit measurement or month, then we wouldn't be having this problem, Ken, but I don't think you would like that.
Please, let our debaters debate, please.
Could we continue to have a civil debate here? I hope so. The point that I do want to make is that it's always avoiding the question that needs to be addressed. What happened in Nevada, what happened in San Juan County, is inherently dangerous to BLM employees, to federal employees, to state employees. The idea that a 5 or 7 year old can be riding on the handlebars of an ATV with an automatic weapon held by the driver is absolutely, in anybody's sense, unsafe. If that's the kind of way that we're going to have the states managing public lands, then heaven help us. It's not responsible. It's not something our children or our grandchildren would be proud of. We need to come up with answers that we can solve as a community. It's not a finger-pointing game. It's a game of coming up with solutions. Let's look at the Recreation and Public Trust Act and see ways that we can rationalize the landscape instead of spending all this money on lawyers and litigation.
30 seconds.
I think it's important that when we leave here today, we resolve that we will work as citizens of Utah and citizens of the United States to come up with sustainable solutions into the future. And the idea that we're going to sit around and flip a switch and we're going to be in charge by God is not going to solve the problems that have happened in the last 10 days or 10 weeks.
Time. Okay, Team B, Ken Ivory, for your closing statement. You have 2 minutes starting now.
Thank you. Under Pat Shea's BLM, the federal government locked up 1.8 million acres without talking to a single Utahan. They did it despite the Council for Environmental Quality saying, I'm increasingly of the view that we should just drop these Utah ideas. These lands are not really endangered. And yet they did it without talking to a single Utahan. week ago, Commissioner Darren Bushman from Paiute County called me and said the Forest Service wanted to do a 40 to 50,000 acre prescribed burn. And they asked him a simple question. Can we go in and take out any usable timber before you burn the forest? They said, no, that'd be a commercial harvest. You'd have to have an environmental impact statement, and there'd be litigation for years. We can't let you take out anything usable. We just have to burn it all up. You know, up in Heber, there's a company that takes standing dead timber they can cull out of the state and local and private forests, and they can build homes that are 75% more energy efficient out of dead standing timber. And they do that without burning the wood up into the environment, without burning the animals and destroying the watershed for generations. With policies like this, these failed policies, where you could take, and there's millions of homes, millions of homes in standing dead timber that they simply will not allow for productive activity. With policies like this, rigid and failed policies like this, it makes you wonder, do they really care about the people on the ground and the lives and livelihoods? Or do they just simply want to watch the world burn?
30 seconds. TD. Dan McCool. Dan McCool, you have 2 minutes for your closing statement, starting now.
A few years ago, Pat and I were part of a team that traveled to Iron County to try to see if we can't find some resolution to the RS-2477 roads issue there. And we called together as many different stakeholders as we possibly could. There had to be at least 30 or 40 people around the table. And everybody was there. The environmental groups and the ATVers and the ranchers and farmers and local officials and the Bureau of Land Management, everyone was sitting around that table. And as I sat there and I looked around, I thought, you know, there's no bad guys here. What I saw around that table were my fellow Utahns, my fellow Americans. And I realized that if we can just come together and we can actually start talking to one another and listening, not just talking, but also listening, that we can make real progress on these kinds of issues. That if we collaborate and we negotiate and we work out these hard problems together as friends and neighbors, instead of this very high conflict approach that our good friends are advocating, which I think will create problems rather than solve problems. If we can talk together, the Utah contingent and
30 seconds.
The people from the BLM and all those many, many different interest groups, we can actually solve problems. Keep in mind tonight that this is actually a great problem to have. We're here arguing over how we manage an incredibly precious resource that we all love. That's a really good problem to have. Let's work it out. Thank you all for being here tonight.
Thank you to our debaters.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Closing statement from Becky Lockhart. 2 minutes, starting now.
I've spent most of the past year traveling around the state of Utah, talking to local elected officials and countless members of the public. It's what we do as state officials. I've crossed paths with the governor, the lieutenant governor, the Senate president, and dozens of members of the Utah House and Senate doing the same thing. Why do we do it? Because local officials are accountable. We know we are accountable. And let's not fool ourselves. Federal bureaucrats thousands of miles away are accountable to no one. It won't be a Washington bureaucrat who looks in the eyes of the Beaver County commissioners when they express their concerns about feral horses and the damage they have caused to the lands and the economy. I did. It won't be a Washington bureaucrat who looks in the worried eyes of a homeowner in San Pete County, concerned that his life's work will burn to the ground.
1 minute.
Because fences don't know the difference between federal and state lands. Utah's Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox did. It won't be a Washington bureaucrat who looks in the eyes of a hotel owner at the entrance of a national park and promises to reopen the parks. county commissioners, and sheriffs did. Who then will best manage public lands in Utah? President Hoover said this in 1929. Our western states have long since passed from their swaddling clothes and are today more competent to manage much of these affairs than is the federal government. We must seek every opportunity to slow the expansion of federal bureaucracy and place our communities in control of their own destinies. Who should manage the public lands in Utah? Utahns. Thank you.
10 seconds. Well done, debaters. Well done. Okay, the debate is over. And now the vote is in the hands of our audience. Again, pull out those cell phones. Send a text to this number, 22333. That's 22333. In the message line this time, if you support the resolution that the state of Utah is best suited to manage public lands within its borders, you can type the word local and hit send. If you oppose the resolution, type NATL, the abbreviation for national. Again, capitalization does not matter, but be careful not to insert a space or misspell the key word. You've got a couple of minutes to cast your votes. Again, depending on your texting plan, you may find a little charge on your bill. And one phone number gets one vote. As the votes are tallying, a few thank yous. Thanks to the Hinckley Institute of Politics, especially Morgan Lyon-Cotty and Elise Bali. Also KCPW, especially Tyler Ford and Ed Sweeney for partnering with us. Thanks to the Salt Lake City Library, in particular Aleko Campos and Elizabeth King for providing this facility. And of course, a hearty thank you to our terrific panelists, Professor Dan McCool, Patrick Shea, Representative Ken Ivory, and Speaker Becky Lockhart. Thank you so much for participating. The votes are still coming in. It looks as if there hasn't been much of a change. Perhaps we're all set in our ways. The winner of tonight's debate, it appears to be those opposed to the resolution. Congratulations. We hope this has been an enlightening as well as entertaining way to discuss this important policy issue. And for much more coverage about public lands, of course, go to the website, sltrib.com. And from all of us at the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you so much for being here tonight and engaging with us. Good night.